Welcome to Two Dope Boys and a Podcast. I'm Phil McKenzie.
I'm Michael Brooks.
Two Dope Boys is a shout out from the margins. Each week, we will break down trends using the lens of culture to shed light on what's impactful to your future and why. What's up, brother?
How you doing, brother?
Doing good, doing good.
Great to be on another expedition with you. We got super producer Matt Leck with us, as always, holding it down, making it all possible, and an illustrious.
Okay.
Dope.
Okay.
Extraordinary.
Okay.
Tribe Called Quest t-shirt wearing member of our crew back on our second time with us, fresh off of our taping together for Dating Show.
Am.
Miss Georgette Pierre. Let everybody again
know who I am.
Who you are.
Hi, Georgette, a.k.a. Dear Georgette.
Dear Georgette on YouTube.
I know, executive producer, writer, host of my YouTube series, Dear Georgette, write for VH1, used to write for MTV, and then I'm doping with my boys for this podcast.
Member of our crew.
Crew love.
Always crew love.
Always crew love. Everybody loved you.
I appreciate
the first
y'all.
Time.
I'm excited to be back.
We appreciate you immensely. Now let's go to something that none of us appreciate. That is the brand apology, the brand F up, the brand foul play of the week. Phil, what do we got?
I'm just salivating.
He literally is. I'm like, dude, you want to get that on the mic?
Oh, this man.
That's a little foul.
This is
wipe your lips off.
This is just wow right now. BuzzFeed just came.
Boo.
Just came with it last week and dropped one of their infamous or maybe now infamous videos, 27 questions black people have for other black people. And this video is crazy. And they've already apologized for it. I'll read the video. I'll read the apology right now. It's an apology via Twitter. Mm. And what they took a lot of time thinking about this one. Their apology reads via BuzzFeed video. We've heard your concerns about last week's video. We made a mistake and want to get better at earning the trust of our black audience. End apology. Unbelievable. This video needs to be seen and heard to really get the full scope of it.
Why is it so hard to be on time? Like, why does 5 to 10 always become 20 to 30? If my dab is on fleek, am I lit?
Why is it a problem if I like anime?
Why do black people look at your shoes before they greet you?
Why are we more likely to engage in the new dance trend than we are to get involved in politics or opening a business?
How did watermelon become our thing? Like, everybody should love watermelon.
Why do you get upset when I don't like a black celebrity?
Race aside, some people are just terrible.
Why do we call each other the N-word, but get vehemently upset when a white person uses the N-word?
Phil Space is actually the hilarious
You want to just give him a touch more of this?
Yeah,
touch
okay.
more.
You got to go a little, a few more. Okay. Just a few more.
You got to go a few more bars.
It drains my soul to hear the word, and I just don't understand how people who have any understanding of history can use that word.
Why is my natural hair, the hair that grows out of my head, seen as a political statement?
Why do we think people with light skin look better than people with dark skin?
Do you really believe that black is beautiful?
Or is that just something you say because it sounds cool?
Why do some black people say that you're pretty for a dark-skinned girl?
When that is said to me, it still makes me feel like the ugliest little black thing.
Why do some black men only date white women?
Why is it okay for black men to date white women, but not okay for a black woman to date outside her race?
Why do you protest black?
Oh, yeah. Gosh.
Man, okay. You gotta let us know what you think,
Phil,
of Georgette.
You're
please.
So funny. You're
tell
so
him,
funny.
Tell us.
Okay, so can I say first thoughts before we watch it a second time? First thoughts. The video was really kind of, it was corny to me, but it wasn't corny in the sense of like, oh, I'm offended. So in reality, some of these questions we've asked each other. I don't think it was necessarily a video that BuzzFeed had to use as content for their website. I think it was just kind of, it was a dumb video. Like, out of all the things that you all create, BuzzFeed, you went to 27 questions black people ask other black people. I don't ask other black people those types of questions, though. I don't give a shit. In all fairness, there were some things that some of the questions that they asked, I think they were stupid funny. And we've joked about it between other people. But the biggest thing that I noticed, and there's probably the dumbest criticism, just because I've trained as a host, they were reading from a teleprompter. That actually, I think, bothered me more than the fucking questions. Listen, I know my criticism is different than everybody else's. I thought it was stupid. I think BuzzFeed could have just, I mean, if you're looking for content, you could have gone elsewhere.
Well, I don't really, I mean, I have any criticism per se. It's just I've been noting these questions. I've been writing them down, and I would like an answer, guys.
You want to answer those questions?
Yeah, Bill, like, why? Bill. First of all, Georgette and Phil always look at my shoes before they look at me. And I have been, I think I've spent enough time in the community in order to be able to use the N-word. So I would really, I'm going to say, like, joking aside, I have no doubt. Because, like, everybody asks every question imaginable.
Right.
And everybody, like, you know, I've heard the weirdest Jewish shit at a Passover dinner. So there's nothing, like, unique about anybody in regards to that. But the way I did read it when I first saw it, I was like, because it's BuzzFeed, I'm like, this is, it's probably not true. But the visual I had was some white dude sitting there being like, I've always been curious about this, like kind of sketching something out. And it makes me want to do the Def Jam comedy voice, like, for real.
Right.
Because again, the other aspect is just the mind bending corniness of everything down to them not being able to read off of a teleprompter.
Correct.
Yeah. Corny aside, I do think, yes, it was all of those things
and fucked up,
but it reinforces when you're BuzzFeed and you have a huge platform and your business is making viral videos and things that are built to spread, and you have this video that panders to, like, kind of these lowest common denominator questions, then it becomes not really just entertainment. It becomes like part of your propaganda.
Definitely.
And I think that's what was so problematic, and that's what really resonated to me, because I don't really have I don't really even fuck with a lot of this stuff, like these videos and things like
right,
that. So
right.
It was really the backlash that I saw before I even saw the video, because I'm not really checking for BuzzFeed like that. But at the same time, when I watched it, I was like, are you serious right now? Mm-hmm. Like, you can't be serious with
and
these,
can I,
with these
I
questions.
I just have to say, like, two friends of mine texted me, both of whom are black, right? Like, two people I know texted me before. I had never, and I wouldn't have come across this video without this being texted to me.
Neither would I.
Yeah. And I got a text, and then both of them just wrote, brand fuck up 2DB. Like, literally, like, I'm paraphrasing, but like, it was such a natural slot. Like, you need to cover this on your show. This is fucking dumb. And I just have one quick question for both of you, because I mean, through my joke, I shared what my opinion is on it. We talked a lot. I mean, Phil and I talk all the time about this, and we actually talked specifically about this, three of us, and the last time you were on, Georgette, is like the revelation in some respects of like who's in the room by the content being produced. And I really did have some sense of like, there's a, like, even with BuzzFeed, which actually is diverse, relatively speaking, but like, there's clearly a problem in the room there. I mean, that's just my, and again, that's just my, I shouldn't say clearly, it's just my opinion. I'm not psychic. I don't know, but that was my read. Like, so, how did this go forward?
Right.
Yeah.
Like, where was the breaker on this on any number of levels?
The first thing that comes to mind, I mean, in writing and being in the writer's room with, you know, when you're writing for websites, this is just pretty much, to Phil's point, it was low hanging fruit.
Yeah.
And that's what they call it. When you just
shortcut.
When you just need something that's just going to pop very quickly and you just need some numbers, you go for the low hanging fruit. And it's unfortunate that people of color have to be that low hanging fruit.
And it's inaccurate low hanging fruit.
Right.
That's what bothered me. Like, if you just take a look at the title, you know, 27 questions that black people ask other black people or whatever, it's like, I went to Howard. Like, you know, I went to like a super black place at the blackest time you can be there.
Right.
Like 90s.
Right.
You know, like, Howard didn't get no blacker than in the 90s.
Phil had like the Malcolm X cap with the Spike Lee movies. 90s.
That was
right.
Black branded college experience. And we never talk about these things. Like, this is just,
you know, that's
so wholly inaccurate and silly. Like, it reminds me of those conservative periodicals around the same time that would use like the bell curve to pretend that they're posing a question, like, are black people really less intelligent? Just a question.
Yeah.
Like, the question by its nature is fucked up.
And the way it was so sanctimonious, and it did read to me like disclosure for, like, frankly, a bunch of white people sharing it, being like, yeah, these are big questions. Like, that's how it read. It didn't read to me. Like, again, I use that Jewish example. Like, it didn't read to me like, this is somebody who has insight about, like, a Passover table, and it's kind of funny and maybe uneasy, but it's accurate. It read more like, no, like, Jews don't sit around being like, why do we control the world's buddy supply, guys?
It's super insulting. Like, if I think about,
yeah, that's how it read.
If I think about one thing that, like, one of the women in the video said, where she makes a statement, and it's one of the ones we played, that, you know, why are black people more likely to know the latest dance steps rather than to be involved in politics? I'm like, motherfucker, we got a goddamn black president.
Yeah.
You know, Black Lives Matter.
Right.
Like, people are literally, young people are literally on the front lines of changing political movements, like
risking their physical safety.
Yeah, the women's suffrage movement came out of the abolitionist movement. Like, over a quarter of the people who fought in the Civil War were people of color. Like, there's just this narrative that, like, black people are passive to their own liberation and movement, that things like that, coupled with a whole lot of other bullshit, reinforce. And that's what made me so pissed off.
That was gross.
So to be fair, I'm so glad that when you sent me the link, I hadn't read any of the criticisms, because a lot of the times I don't like to be influenced by other people's opinions or thoughts. So that's why, to me, I was just like, oh, it's corny. Okay, I can stop watching this now. But to your point, and I hate the term devil's advocate, but to be played devil's advocate, so how you were saying that, Phil, that this stuff was never a conversation in the 90s. I know for me, not to age myself, because I'm not that old, there were a couple of questions that they have been, you know, presented in my time coming up in high school. So some of those things I was familiar with, but I think a lot of the other questions that just were kind of like asked backwards were things that have been presented now, and I think they contradicted, the questions they asked contradicted what was happening now, right? So why, you know, what was the one about the Black Lives Matter, right?
Yeah, like, why are black people more likely to know dance steps than,
can I also
know,
just interject, even again, without being like specific to this example, it's that's fucking stupid. There is no contradiction between knowing the latest dance step and being vitally engaged in politics.
Well, can you,
like, that to me, just even generally,
can you name a race?
In the scope, is just a dumb fucking juxtaposition generally.
Is there any grouping of people on earth that is more political than they dance?
Right. Yeah. Like, that, yeah, exactly. Like, that's just a weird, and again, that's where I had this image of, like, the suburban white archetype sharing this video being like, see?
Right, exactly.
And that's where I actually recoil.
See, we're not wrong in asking these questions, because look, they answer them too. Like,
and that's a distinction, because I am, like, my role, like, I don't recoil at, like, I'm not quote unquote PC in that way. Like, everybody has their shit and their whatever, and that's fine. But I'm more like, if you're gonna put something out like this that is corny, dumb, poorly designed, feeds off of some really destructive ideas, and then that's going to be like, I know it's going to be weaponized in an email chain. That's when I get really concerned on my angle.
And it could have been such a good opportunity too for, like, actual questions black people ask to other black people, but instead it's like, what do white people ask that they wish black people would ask so they could listen to it?
Yeah.
That's the perfect way of putting it.
It's bullshit, man.
Dumb as fuck. Let's go to What's Up. Do better, BuzzFeed.
Now we want to jump into What's Up. And What's Up comes to us today from the world of Hollywood. This has been making the rounds for a while. Recently, we've seen the first footage that comes from a Hollywood adaptation of a very popular, long-running anime series called Ghost in the Shell. This movie originally was announced last year and made some initial headlines because Scarlett Johansson, very popular Hollywood actress, everyone knows who ScarJo is, was signed on to be the main character in this movie. And the character's name, for those who are not familiar, is Major Motoko Kusanagi.
Which translates from Japanese into English as Scarlett Johansson.
Exactly. Exactly. So,
shade.
So here we have the most recent version of Hollywood whitewashing, where a story that is and a history that is well known in science fiction and fantasy and anime circles, Ghost in the Shell, has been repurposed and now rebranded with the major with the main character being portrayed by Scarlett Johansson. And like I said, the first photos of her in the movie have surfaced, and the internet went crazy. Because now they're finally getting, it's one thing to see the actress being announced, and it's another thing to see her shown as this character. And as a well-known nerd, blurred, whatever you want to call me, I'm very familiar with Ghost in the Shell. It's one of my favorite anime series. This is a movie I will not go to see. And
you heard it here first.
It's just terrible that they've decided to go this route. And, It touches on a lot of different business things. It's a cultural conversation, it's a business conversation as to why Hollywood persists in going this route with making these movies, particularly with the failures they've had, the very recent failures they've had with doing this very same thing. Johnny Depp being cast as Tonto in The Lone Ranger, huge failure. The Gods of Egypt movie came out very recently. In complete disaster and failure. Emma Stone in Aloha, depicting a multiracial Asian woman, that movie also a failure. So as much as people argue that Hollywood needs to go after bankable stars, there's more and more evidence to show that that's actually not the case. So I'm curious to hear what you guys have to say about this most recent case of whitewashing.
So my thoughts about that was, and I'm glad you brought those up, because that was what I was trying to think about too, as other movies. Listen, the casting controversy isn't new, and the fact that we're acting like it is. I know when I was reading one of the articles that you sent, Phil, Max Landis, he's a screenwriter, was explaining Hollywood and how it really works. So I think there's blame in three different ways, right? So it's the people in Hollywood, they're the casting, the directors, whoever that's choosing these characters. But there needs to be also partial blame on the actors that are saying yes to these jobs, knowing damn well that this is going to cause controversy.
Right.
You know damn well you are not Asian, you have no features of an Asian or a Japanese woman, and if you read the story, like I'm presuming that they do before they take these roles, you know the background of this, and so you know you are a white woman taking an Asian role. And the third person, or the third group, is the consumers, right? I know that the change through Hollywood is going to be a slow process, but I think where it can start is affecting change on the consumer end, similar to how he just said he's not going to support this movie. The casting controversy is never going to go away. I was just kind of like, okay, Max, that's cool. You're a screenwriter that just sold a couple of films that you're making more than 6-7 figures on. I don't necessarily know if I could really take you seriously in the regards of you explaining Hollywood to me. I'm a woman of color. I already know what this looks like. You know, not to say that he's not supporting or whatever, but his explanation doesn't do any change for what's happening with the Hollywood casting controversy, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I mean, it makes complete sense to me. I'm not going to...
And I'm not knocking him, just to be clear.
All right, Georgia hates you. no, but I wouldn't to be perfectly honest, I probably wouldn't be seeing this movie regardless, but it will add to it, because there's a slight possibility I would have seen this movie with Phil had he been seeing it,
right?
So that does affect me. But I have two thoughts on this. I mean, one, I think that there is a certain positive movement in culture, because obviously this type of thing has been going on from time immemorial, right? Like this, you know, okay, like the Queen of Egypt is a white lady, whatever. Like, all this is as old as the industry.
Jesus,
exactly, yep. Exactly.
And I mean, that
certainly predates the industry, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, white Jesus is a whole other conversation. I can kind of rock that look actually when I grow my hair out. But regardless, I appreciate that. But regardless, I think where we see some movement in culture in a positive direction is just how ludicrous it is. Like, there's something on its face that's like, I think even relative to 10 or 20 years ago, that I was like, what? Like, why would a blonde actress play a Japanese character. It doesn't make any sense. That's just fucking dumb. I think the other point that is very central to our work and the ethos of this show, not to like kind of take it too heavy, but part of the work we do in this show and with clients and everybody else is like really taking seriously this question of like, are you motivated by, you know, love or fear? And I think it's, and love can be, you know, it doesn't need to be all out there. It could be, you know, love of good storytelling, love of proper casting, love of putting a story together right. And to me, like in something so obvious as this, the bankable prediction of putting Scarlett Jo in there, that's the fear decision.
Yeah.
That's what it's about. I mean, it's racial fear, it's economic fear. I think in the case of Hollywood, it's much more economic fear because I don't think people involved in this decision are like, well, we don't want Japanese. I think it's just like, you gotta have Scarlett Jo do it because that's, you know, because that's box office. And that whole motivation set leads to the perpetuating of racism and the depletion of culture because it sucks.
Yeah.
It's like, what's interesting? In fact, I'm not an anime person, but if you cast like an interesting Japanese actress I'd never heard of or encountered in a format and a medium that I wasn't familiar with, and I was like, wow, that's new to me. Not like, oh, okay, so Scarlett Johansson's a Japanese chick, and that's literally just bait for like, I'm just texting during the ad at the cinema while I watch this. It's totally irrelevant to me.
And it's very circular reasoning in the sense that if you look at Scarlett Johansson's career, you know, she is a bankable actress. Like, absolutely, there is no mistaking that. But when she's in the Avengers, she's the person that they don't really, like, they don't merchandise her stuff. Yeah, they don't really respect her stuff. And if you look at the cast, her fellow castmates, she's arguably the biggest star of the entire cast. Like, she's the one who can really kind of open a movie.
You think so?
Definitely.
From the Avengers.
Yeah.
I disagree.
Chris Hemsworth ain't a star.
Robert Downey Jr.
He opened Iron Man.
Yeah,
if he's in something that ain't Iron Man, he don't open. She opens movies that ain't superhero movies.
Okay, so you're saying I see what point you're coming from now. Okay.
So that's what I'm saying. Like,
arguably, go at him, Georgette.
Mark Ruffalo don't open movies. He does indie movies, but he ain't the guy that's gonna be like, Mark Ruffalo opened a $50 million.
And I saw him in Central Park too.
Yeah, he's a cool dude. Yeah.
He opened Central Park. Boom.
Riding on the train.
He's a cool dude. So
yeah, he really is.
She opens movies, but that just shows how fucked up Hollywood is because she's the biggest star. And when she's doing a domestic film with white male actors, she gets the short end of the stick.
Yeah.
From the merchandising perspective. Yeah. But when put in a context where the characters and the stories are from people of color, in this case, a Japanese/Asian culture, she now gets elevated.
You know what it was from one of the articles I read? I know they're also going off of how well Lucy did, which I have not seen yet. But it's the economic fear, and Hollywood is kind of getting, we all know Hollywood is trying to recycle movies, continue to create sequels off of shit that we're tired of seeing. And I think Scarlett Jo, and I'm actually kind of confused on why they went with her though, but I guess she was the safe choice. I don't know much about the story like you do, Phil, but I don't necessarily know if she, even if they didn't want to go to the Japanese route, there has to be more of the pool of women that you can pull from for this.
They went with someone, like, being that she's done something like Lucy, seeing that she's played Black Widow in the Avengers, that's why they went with her. Like, the character in Ghost in the Shell is like a cybernetic character.
Right.
Whose body, like, she's a cyborg and she can plug into like computers and she can fight and jump off buildings and all this kind of shit. And really, Ghost in the Shell is very forward thinking. So if you look at like the images in Ghost in the Shell, it actually influenced like The Matrix and all those kind of movies. So this is something that's been around since the 90s. And
nerd.
So, nerd. Definitely nerd. And from that perspective, given her recent work, I understand the casting. But from the cultural perspective, and then from a business perspective, when Hollywood is churning out blockbusters primarily to service Asian markets, whether it's China or the greater Asian markets, why not cast a notable actress that comes from that world? Because you have fans here who are already kind of familiar with the work. And they'll go to see it. And then you are already naturally appealing to an overseas market. Like, it makes, from a business perspective and from a cultural perspective, is a shortcut that costs them money. I think this movie will fail.
I think, and we should put the link up. I just quickly wanted to share. I know they had a, because I didn't connect the dots until you sent me the link, but the article about Japanese actresses that they could have chosen mm-hmm. to play this role. And one person that came up is, I hope I say her name right, Tao Okamoto. She was one of the few people that they listed, but just, it was just an interesting article I think people should read and look at. And I know these are not A-list women, but again, there's just some authenticity is needed. Fuck. Shit.
Yeah. But we gotta change that definition of A-list.
Yep. And that in effect change on the consumer end, and hopefully that triggers up.
My last thought on this is, I would go back, if you haven't listened already, and obviously a lot of you have, but some people are new, go back to our conversation on the Oscars that Phil and I had. And we went deeper than that, because the thing was, that even beyond the Oscars, whatever, was just, what do you do in a world that, you know, the default isn't a certain setting. It isn't white in this instance. And I think, you know, that's just the reality of a global world, and this kind of awkward, you know, like dumb move like this, it's not right, and it also doesn't fit with the emergence of a different map of our experience.
Yeah, and it loses you money. At the end of the day, all of these cases, Airbender, another popular movie that, well, a failed movie that was an adaptation of a very popular Nickelodeon show, where the entire world and setting is a East Asian, South Asian kind of experience, the iconography, the characters, everything about them visually. Then they casted like primarily all white actors for the hero roles and kept the anti-hero villain roles as sort of people of color. Movie failed, you know, one of the M. Night Shyamalan failures, you know. So this is not just a cultural diversity conversation. This is a conversation about your wallets. Like, you're actually, by not taking a longer look at this, you're risking hundreds of millions of dollars down the drain at movies that fail. And that's what's up.
All right, so now we got to get to what's good. And everybody knows that with us, we have the Empress of Dating.
Oh,
Her Majesty
that
is Dating.
That is a title for your
ass. Yeah, that is, yeah, exactly. Exactly.
I got to pull away from the mic.
Exactly.
You said a title for your ass.
A title for your ass.
I wasn't ready for all of that.
Empress of Dating.
I won't even say
all I that. Was on the Empress's show taping with
yes.
her recently.
Yes, I can't wait for you to see it.
And might I just say,
I did
a tremendous job. That's true.
It's true.
Georgette, would you like to co-sign on the reality?
Real quick, so I definitely had Michael on Dear Georgette. I had to Dear Georgette his ass, and he did
killed
well.
It.
He actually did two episodes
killed
for me.
It.
I initially booked him for one,
and I killed it so much I did more. Just say it yourself. Don't resist it.
He did two episodes, so I can't wait for y'all to see that. It
because
you fuck with me.
Because also
you're an asshole boyfriend.
Yes, but because also.
Oh gosh. Anywho.
Whatever. See, this is why it'll never work between the sexes. That kind of nonsense right there. All right. But speaking of trends mm-hmm. that might work us towards working things out between the sexes, or just completely creeping me the fuck out.
It should.
We have some trends in dating, and we have an article that I'm pulling this from the Telegraph in the UK, which we will link to on Two Dope Boys pod on the website. It goes over several trends that we're going to see in the coming decades in the proliferation of the online dating market. I'm going to give them to you, and then I'm going to read a quote which reflects my skepticism and disgust and open up the conversation. But this is according to, and I'm quoting now from the Telegraph, according to a new report, full sensory and virtual reality behavior-based matching will be among the key features of dating in the year 2040. These developments will save singles time and energy and deliver more accurate matches and even provide insight and real-time assistance. The report, commissioned by relationship site eHarmony and compiled by management students at Imperial College Business Schools, and based on an analysis of more than 100 trends and interviews with leading experts across the fields of anthropology, sociology, technology, and biomedicine. I have to just add, as a parenthesis here, reports like this are awesome and they provide insight, but you know, this ain't 3 + 3 = 6. That said, the findings reveal a, quote, supercharged continuation of today's online dating trends. And I'm just going to skip ahead. Quote, by 2040, we estimate that 70% of couples will get together online, with technology revolutionizing the way we find love and build relationships, said a eHarmony UK manager, Roman Bertrand. Well, I wonder why the eHarmony manager would be optimistic about that stat.
Of course.
And here are the top lines. Full century virtual dating. You can go on dates in virtual reality. Biotechnology, which will allow people to get a better sense of how their genes match, which is, of course, actually is a genuinely important part of physical attraction. Behavior-based matching, which is an expansion of dating sites like Happn, which kind of base you, and Tinder as well, which actually that base you on location. This amplifies that to behavior. What are you into? What are you doing with your time? Then we have artificial intelligence, which will be used to improve connectivity and create learning experiences. This is interesting stuff. I'm just going to read a quote from Nassim Nicholas Taleb from The Bed of Procrustes, which is, asking science to explain life and vital manners is equivalent to asking a grammarian to explain poetry. Georgette, what do you think?
What do I think? I've always been skeptical of online dating because I've tried it, and to be fair, I only tried it for a week. So
big sample.
A big sample. Big sample. I mean, listen,
big enough, Phil.
No. To be fair, I definitely, it's scary because a lot of people are actually jumping on the virtual reality bandwagon, and I think a lot of these things, what's actually kind of disturbing is a lot of things are moving towards technology on the way you meet people, the way you interact with people, the way you just kind of deal with people. And it's just, it's reducing the you and me. I prefer the traditional ways about how we communicate, you know. I've even kind of struggled with the traditional dating in the sense of being where you need to be. So with the full sensory and the DNA matching and the artificial intelligence, I think a lot of people are feeling like they're in a rut on how to kind of find a significant other or dating, and a lot of people are really going to jump towards this. I mean, with some of the other articles that I had read about dating and some of these apps like Tinder, a lot of people are on these apps. I mean, like, we could be in a bar right now, all of us, and people are on their phone swiping left, swiping right. But I'm sitting right next to you, but this is becoming the new norm. And I think that's what's disturbing about some of the trends that they're projecting with this article. So, yeah, traditional.
Yeah, I think virtual reality is interesting. The mm-hmm. technology piece to human relationships and all the rest of that stuff, I think it's interesting, but I think what you're missing out is that feeling of serendipity, that thought process that in any given moment outside of a technological aid, you can meet another person and potentially connect with them. There've been a lot of studies that have shown that as much as we use these sort of romanticized tropes, i.e. opposites attract, that's something you hear everyone's been saying forever, you know, that's not a new saying, but that is actually not really true, that people do tend to coalesce around certain values, whether those things are also economic in mindset or what have you. People tend to meet around certain things that they can share, whether those are educational things, physical attraction elements, what have you. And so there's not as much of that opposites attract as one would think in maybe the romanticized movies and songs that kind of fuel our pop culture yearnings.
No, but I think like dance hall songs about sex are way more accurate than R&B songs about love.
Yeah. There's
they're actually blurring the line so they sound the fucking same.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, no, I don't know what you're listening to.
R&B songs about love?
I'm listening to some vulgarity. yeah, but let me, it's like they're like becoming like just straight up like gyno exams at this point. But I think the thing that I would add to that really quickly though is that, and this is something that, again, Phil and I talk about a lot, does virtual reality amplify and supplement, or is there an attempt to substitute? Which I think is exactly what you guys are getting to, right? Mm-hmm. If it's used to amplify and supplement, that could be very cool. But I think it's, at least in a way like this is framed, it's going to be a substitute for all of the synchronicities and unexpected kind of qualitative things. And then what's interesting to me is that, like, let's look at where it's actually is being rolled out right now. I mean, you said earlier, Pornhub, right?
Yeah.
They like, the real way in which these things are being reeled out right now is in supplementary non-physical fantasy experiences, which are not on the love and dating track. They're on the porn track.
Yeah. Pornhub launched their VR product about,
which, like, again, like, no, yeah, no hate. I'm just documenting, like, where these things play out.
It's just
out.
The reality of where the test case is going to be. You know, Pornhub VR is...
Excuse me, let me turn the phone down. Sound on my phone.
Exactly. It's become a thing, you know, where people, maybe they're not even swiping left, swiping right in a bar. As to your point, Georgette, is like, are they going even further, you know, while they're in these public spaces? And that substitute versus supplement argument is pretty critical.
So there was an article that I had read called The Business of Love, and it was talking about three different apps. Apps that I've never heard of, but the app was called, and this is from Stanford Business School, Business of Love. Three dating app founders talk trends in online making, and these apps were called Kick Off, The League, and Coffee Meets Bagel. And they were basically talking about different trends in 2016, and each one varied. But one that was very interesting, to the point that Phil made, was, or maybe it was you, Michael, but both of you all, about geographical area as well. And Kick Off literally focuses on Brazil and expanded through South America. And one of their points is that's the one area where, because, you know, when you're on a dating app, there has to be some level of trust, right? And South America is the one area where there isn't a lot of trust. And so they kind of honed in on using that as their space to kind of build on their app. And the one thing that they do is, you know, with dating apps, for people that have tried it, you have to connect through Facebook. Well, Kickoff does Facebook and LinkedIn. So now you have to kind of double back, you know, with kind of authenticating yourself and kind of building more of a trust. And so that's kind of how they got people pulled in South America. But the point with the one article that we were talking about with the virtual dating, Michael, that you referenced, it's getting to the point where I think it is becoming a substitution, but I think we are getting too comfy with that. And I think people are just kind of, I don't want to call people desperate, but I think that if you're getting to the point that where virtual dates are becoming okay to you, that's a problem. But I think they know they're feeding into a generation that's constantly on their phones, and you're going to just how we talked about the Instagram algorithms on the first episode I was on. I think this is what's happening with online dating, and that's a problem to me. So when you start to build, like, oh, well, I think if we do this and we can tweak that and this happens, then we'll get more of a response. But this is not Instagram. This is your life. This is your personal your livelihood. I don't like the idea of algorithms and kind of what's going to happen with technology in the next 25 years with dating.
Yeah, and people get used to different things.
They do. Yeah.
You know, like, now people are used to like texting last minute plans, you know, like,
right.
When me and Michael talk about dating, you know, I remember you had to make plans with someone. Mm-hmm, you had to, there were no cell phones, you know, there was no way to, if you met a girl on Saturday and you wanted to see her the next Saturday, you had to make plans with her like Wednesday. That was pretty much your cutoff, because if you didn't make plans on Saturday for that next Saturday, you weren't able to get her. There was no, like, you were calling and getting an answering machine or a voicemail something like that. There was no, like, I'm on the Lower East Side with my boys. That shit's kind of corny. It's 11 o'clock. Where are you? You know, and then you just hook up where she is with maybe her friend. Phone? What's up?
Did you hack my phone?
I did hack your phone. That Lower East Side date. Yeah, man. I'm on it.
Yeah, you really are.
No, you know, it's...
High tech, Jensen.
So it went from that to, I actually now have to, people that I make plans with, I have to text them the day of to just double check. And it should never feel that way. If I make plans with you, Michael, right. It should be our plans, yeah. But it's not the case. And I even have people doing that to me, and I think it's the culture that we're in now where you're just like, they could cancel on me at any time through a text message, you know, because it's less, you know, direct, yep, and yep, aggressive, and they don't feel as bad, but it's just, yeah, it's traditional.
No, I agree with you. Ways. I mean, the only last thing I would say, yeah, is that, you know, I know this is a common theme. It's not a question of resisting these changes because they're going to happen, mm-hmm, and they're going to be implemented. But I think I'm very confident that there's going to be a desire for a reemergence of everything from basic etiquette to deeper social and emotional skills that are going to be required to handle the demands of playing with these technologies. And with everything from what you're talking about, Georgette, to ghosting, which we've talked about before.
Fadeaway, I like to call it fadeaway.
The fadeaway, all of that.
Thank you.
Like, we see, of course, you're the Empress of Dating.
Copyright.
We see the consequences of people not really being able to healthfully handle these powers. And ultimately, especially in something that is so qualitative, ultimately, I mean, the setup of dating is that you can make it quantitative and there's all sorts of shit that's very unromantic and baseline that people don't want to acknowledge, but ultimately your connection with somebody, and I would argue even outside of the realm of sex and dating and relationships, but, you know, friendship, social bonds, there's questions that are not going to be solved for by technology, and technology can aid and facilitate, but it can't substitute.
I think with what you were saying, Michael, in regards to things are going to kind of maybe go back, I think what we need to be mindful of too is the generation that grew up not even knowing it to begin with.
Definitely.
And I think, you know, and I don't necessarily know if they even have an urge to want to learn the simple basic skills of talking to people outside of social media and outside of their phones. Face to face, like how you're looking at me right now in my Tribe Called Quest shirt.
With that great eye contact that
and
I maintain.
And my sexy voice.
And my totally killing it.
I was
just giving myself
I never knew how
plug.
To do that, Phil. I never knew how to roll my R's like, yeah, that. I just...
That comes in handy.
That's what's good.
Now we want to jump to digging into crates. This is our opportunity to bring to you guys something that we think is interesting that can come from the worlds of literature. It can come from music and come from film. Just some things that may or may not be on your radar that we want to bring to your attention. So, keeping with my blurred/nerd theme, what I want to highlight is an anime film, actually, that was released in 1997 called Perfect Blue. And this is considered one of the psychological thrillers in the anime space. It features a young woman who leaves a J-pop band to go on to be a film actress and starts to have a splintering of her reality and not knowing what's going on in her life, that it's real or not real. And it really precedes a lot of what we think about privacy in a digital space. So I think it's a movie that, though, is from the late 90s, deals with a lot of the issues that we deal with today, meaning what is fame, what is celebrity, where does your reality with your fans begin and end. And again, it's called Perfect Blue and is an anime feature film, and it's really great.
Dope. Georgette.
I want to be last. Thank you very much.
Ooh, the Empress of Dating has demands. No, all right. Either. All right. This is shocking. Anyways, I'll go to mine.
I'm a Leo. Yeah. Shocking.
I'm also a Leo.
I know, but I'm a woman.
I'm a graceful Leo. Anyways, yeah.
He wasn't ready.
Saying something.
Yes,
yeah.
I got him.
Oh, I'm always ready. So I'm going to have to go wonky with you this week. I'm about to put this in your face right now. So David Harvey, who is a geographer, actually. He's a Marxist geographer. He's one of the most interesting thinkers that I've encountered, and a guy who's really helped me make sense of the world would actually be the best way to put it. He wrote a book that came out a couple years ago on the history of neoliberalism, just where that comes from, the pivotal figures in it, whether that's Margaret Thatcher or Deng Xiaoping in China, for that matter. that system, and we've referenced it and we use that terminology, and I think we still need to kind of define it, but that is the building block of our world in many ways and the cause of many of our problems, from economics that aren't working to most people to you know, brands, frankly, that aren't doing as cool shit as they could do. You can always work your way back to that aspect of the problem. And David Harvey, as a theorist and as a scholar, is a great guide to understanding the kind of like idea infrastructure of our world. So Neoliberalism by David Harvey. That's what I got this week.
Can I just say one comment?
Yeah. If
you,
it's complimentary.
And Phil, it shut the fuck up. Let me say what I was... You are
and
some...
booked again.
Solidified.
Yes. No. Love it. You all have some sexy minds. I'm over here listening, and I'm like, man, this is amazing. I had to say that.
That's like in the Wiz Khalifa song and Weedon Boys when they cut in the girls being like, that was amazing.
Oh gosh. Oh no. Is it my turn? It's my turn, right? I mean, gosh. Flick my hair. So I have two, and I have to say I was inspired by Biz because she had two. So
shout out to Busy B.
I know.
Busy B.
Shout
Busy
out
B.
to Biz. She's awesome. One of the books I started reading a while ago and I didn't finish, but I'm going to, is called Master Key System by Charles F. Honnell. And it's a personal development, but it follows the New Thought philosophy for those that are familiar with the book The Secret by Rhonda Byrne. So the law of attraction, creative visualization, really being disciplined in your thought process and attracting the things that you want. And so I wanted to read something briefly from it, but it's a great book and I've been on this shit for some time now. And so this is something for y'all, for y'all minds. Your strength is determined by your mental attitude. If you wish to eliminate fear, concentrate on courage. If you wish to eliminate lack, concentrate on abundance. If you wish to eliminate disease, concentrate on health. Always concentrate on the ideal as an already existing fact. So that's just to give you an idea of what that book is on. And then my second digging in the crates is music. Music. Just kidding.
That was for somebody.
I love you. I love you, Matt. My Tribe Called Quest shirt, rest in peace to Five. But I've been in a Tribe Called Quest mood for the past however long. Even before he passed away. And so, although there are so many classics, the one that is my favorite right now is The Hop. On so Beats good. Rhymes and Life. So,
really
so yeah, Tribe Called Quest. And
that's a great track. System.
Yeah, isn't it?
I spin that track.
I love
the
beat. I love the beat. And so that's what I'm on right now. So yeah, that's my digging in the crates.
Georgette Pierre, thank you.
Of course.
You're the best.
You're the best.
All of our crew is the best. You kill it. Thank you.
Oh, thank you.
Super producer Matt Leck. Thank you. None of this would be possible without you. Phil, I'm so glad that we met a little over a year and a half ago, and that coffee shop conversation turned into a great friendship.
Serendipity, baby.
Many, many great things for people, and we thank all of you for listening and supporting us, and we will be back on Thursday with On Point and next Tuesday, and we just keep going and going and going.
On and on and on till the break of dawn.
Brooklyn, right, baby.
Brooklyn. You must be high smoking dust with Chris Tucker. Your asses don't want this. I put more beeps than the beeps at the premiere of Pocahontas. Word is one, I am the baddest. And all you honeys out there, word is one, you know my status. So come and throw your panties down. This ain't the Barnum Bailey show, I don't get down with the clowns. So why don't you and your friends get with me and my friends? But don't bring your ass by and you ain't got no end. Word is one, it don't stop. Stop, seize your mind, come along and do the hop. You move to the beach, you don't stop. Come on, everybody, do the hop. Even if you cop, you got to come back and do the hop. You move to the beach, you don't stop. You smoking jump rocks, you got to just stop, do the hop. When you come back, you do the hop. You know we don't stop. We on the ghetto prize on the top. You know we come back, we do the hop. The shorties in the place, all the shorty rocks, do the hop. You got to come back and do the hop. We never go pop. You know we come back, we do the hop. This is how it is, we do the hop. You move to the beat, you come on, everybody, don't stop.